and welcome to Run the Table. I'm your host, Bryce Tinson. Obert, how you doing?
Doing very well.
So we have a new dynasty, right?
Yeah.
Right? New dynasty in the NFL.
With the Chiefs.
I don't know if we'll call it a dynasty just yet. But the Chiefs have now won their second Super Bowl in four seasons. And, you know, it was one of the best Super Bowls of my lifetime. I don't know if you would say the same, but yep. I've thoroughly enjoyed watching that game. The two best teams in the NFL duking it out on the football field. It was, you know, the first half, 24-14 Eagles. They really dominated outside of the Nick Bolton fumble return touchdown. Chiefs weren't able to get anything going offensively. Credit to the Eagles defense. And the second half happened.
Fireworks.
You want to give me your thoughts on the game?
Yeah, I think it was one of the, you know, like you said, probably the best Super Bowl I've watched all the way through. You know, really two evenly matched teams. I think that was the main takeaway with the Eagles and Chiefs. That entire game was very nip and tuck. And obviously, I think sometimes we credit to, you know, special teams plays or defensive scores to coaching. But at the end of the day, I think a lot of it just has to do with, you know, players making big time plays or lack of attention to detail, you know, by the Eagles. And I think both of those were involved. I wouldn't necessarily say like, oh, well, that's coaching. It's like, maybe Nick Bolton just stepped up. I don't think Nick Sirianni was telling him, hey, be loose with the ball, Jalen Hurts. Carry it like a loaf of bread. Seriously, we're good. So, I think that sort of thing happens. But I thought that was the main takeaway, which was, you know, the Eagles, from a yardage standpoint, outgained the Chiefs, did all of, you know, the bigger things, probably better for the entirety of the game, but the special teams and defensive score really came back to bite them in the butt. And I think it was the main reason why they lost the game. Because, again, you look at the numbers, you look at everything like that. It was probably in favor of the Eagles. But, great game, came down to the end, and Chiefs were able to pull it out. But I think the main thing that the Eagles will bite themselves with, last year with the Bengals, it was, okay, our O-line could not, you know, protect Joe Burrow, and that was what killed him. In this game, to me, it felt like, at the end of the day, with the Eagles' problem, it was we can't stop the run, we can't run the ball ourselves for the most part, and that was what killed them in the end, because the Chiefs on that last drive, although, you know, got very lucky with a penalty call, which I didn't love, got first down after first down after first down to ice that game. And that was pretty much the difference. I thought, you know, the Chiefs' offense in the second half was unstoppable. Can't say the same thing about the Eagles. But at the same point, it's the Eagles' offense was unstoppable in the first half.
Yep.
And the Chiefs was. So how do you balance that? And I think the balance is these were two really evenly matched teams, and the Chiefs made a couple more, you know, splash defensive special teams plays to win the game. And that was the difference. I don't know if I would, you know, credit that to the head coaches at all. But what I would say is, you know, Chiefs special teams probably made one extra play. Nick Bolton, you know, made that huge play, and that was the end of the game.
But
As far as the holding call, because, you know, it was a huge topic, ESPN, whatever, my takeaway with that was just, hey, man, technically by the textbook, you know, sure, it was holding. But I just feel like so often you see a play like that where it's not called, and whether or not, you know, it's getting away with it or not enough contact or what have you. I just don't like that call on 3rd and 8 in the Super Bowl, and I think a lot of people who didn't like that call felt the same way. Obviously, you know, Bradberry comes back and says it was holding, and that's fine, but again, just would have liked to have seen some, I don't know, would have liked to have seen that call go by the wayside, and then we could have gotten a 148 drive to go with one timeout for the Eagles. But, you know, a lot of people listen. I think Ninkovic didn't like the call. Colin Cowherd didn't like the call. Joel Klatt didn't like the call. Kirk Herbstreit didn't like the call. So obviously Bradberry said he did it, and maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but, and he did grab him, absolutely. But, again, just don't like that call in the situation. And I think outside of that, you know, and the Chiefs won the Super Bowl, there is no asterisk in my opinion. But I do think that these were two really evenly matched teams. And if you play this game 10 times, it goes five.
Yeah,
you
know, absolutely.
Five and five.
Absolutely. Both ways. Yes. Yeah. So there's a bunch of stuff that we're gonna have to get to with this game. Like you mentioned, it's not coaching for the defensive play and the special teams. You know, Kadarius Toney's punt return. I mean, we're talking about Nick Bolton getting a free rush, yes, on Jalen Hurts on that. It was a draw, and Jalen Hurts just straight up dropped the football. Heads-up play by Bolton to pick it up and run for a touchdown where there was nobody in front of him. Also had two blockers. So it was kind of one of those, hey, in order to win the Super Bowl, you're going to need some bounces to go your way. And that was one of those bounces. Right. It was like,
and people have a hard time compartmentalizing that. It always has to be like Mahomes stepped up and Hurts didn't, or you know, Andy Reid was coaching circles around Nick Sirianni. There always has to be something we can point to other than just, well, you know, the Chiefs got a couple of bounces to go their way. It was a pretty evenly matched game, and the Chiefs got the bounces. They won the Super Bowl.
We talked about it last year with the Bengals. It was like the Bengals might not be the best team in the AFC, but they were definitely the luckiest team, and that's what you need in order to make a Super Bowl run. You need to be good, yes, but you also need to have luck on your side. The 49ers playing a game with playing half of a game with a quarterback that literally could not throw the football is very unlucky. Had he been healthy, maybe, you know, they get a few bounces to go their way. With the way that game was going, likely not. But at the same time, it's like you never know because it's the NFL. You never know what could happen, and because it's such a play by play game, and any single play could swing the momentum of the entire game, which isn't really the case in many other sports. It is truly like each play is in a vacuum of itself. You can't say, oh, this was the play that decided the game, or this was the play that decided the game. Because if it did go differently, the rest of the game goes differently too. So there's that. As for the special teams, Kadarius Toney punt return, it was a terrible punt. It was low. The coverage wasn't able to get down there in time.
It wasn't very long.
He had exactly. He had about 10 yards to work with before the first Eagles player was able to get there. And so when he was able to reverse field, you're able to set up that blockade. And with the way the punt team was already going down there, lane integrity gets all screwed up. It was a fantastically blocked play by the Chiefs punt unit or punt return unit, and a poorly covered play by the Eagles punt unit, but also at the same time it's on the punter. If you're able to get some more hang time on that, or even punt it further down, maybe not even further down the field, maybe shorter, it would have ended up as, you know, the Chiefs would have had to drive 50 yards in order to score a touchdown rather than, what was it, 5?
Yep.
So there's that. I'm on the other side of the holding call. I believe, you know, if it is holding, you have to call it regardless of when the game is, because the issue is when you put the moment of the game on the line, you get a no call like you do in the NFC Championship game in 2018. The refs don't want to be
the ones.
A little
bit different there.
It's not, though, because the refs don't want to decide the game. Yes, it was blatant, but the refs don't want to decide the game. They don't want to be the reason. Like, they're always heckled and told by the media, don't, you know, keep the flag in the pocket. Don't be the one to decide the game. And so I think if you just develop this, hey, if it's a flag, throw the flag.
I think there's something different between, hey, let's not, or, you know, if it's a 50-50 call, err on the side of let them play.
It's not. It wasn't a 50-50 call, though. It was holding.
Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But
no, it was. Like, James
he
Bradbury
grabbed his jersey. We see that call, you know, not called all the time, but, I mean, okay.
It is holding. Like,
if I could go back and, you know, go through the entire Super Bowl and see if there's any one Chiefs defender grabbing an Eagles jersey
was.
The rest of the game.
There was. But
you know what I mean?
But there was, but the point is that if you're going to grab, you take that risk. And he did. They threw the flag. You have to live with that. And credit to the Eagles. They did a great job of owning up and taking responsibility and not, you know, blaming the refs and saying, oh, you know, they were letting us play all game. Because there was a play earlier in the game where Bradbury did get away with a little bit of a hook. I think it was on like a third down in the first or second drive for the Chiefs to pass to Juju over the middle.
And when the refs see that, because it was literally who was getting thrown to, and they don't throw a flag, it feels like you're starting a sort of consensus for how the rest of the game should be called.
No, but and that's the problem I have with people is like the refs might call a game a certain way in the first half, but if you
then
are,
they should call it the same way.
But that's not going to happen because it's human error.
It should.
It's not going to. And so you have to know that, hey, if I grab this guy, there is a risk that it's going to get called, and I have to live with that. And James Bradbury did that. He said he hoped it didn't get called. He said, because I think the exact quote was, "I tugged him twice. I hoped they didn't catch me," and they did. So I do think that you have to call it if it is a penalty, and it was. But you know, overall. Like that was a really good game, and I do think that the field played a factor. I went back and watched, and it's like the Eagles' inability to get a pass rush. It was their edge rushers, Hassan Reddick and Brandon Graham. They were literally slipping on their at the top of their break. They weren't able to bend around the corner, and you know. So I did a little bit of looking into the field. I'm sure as many other people did, and it was a combination. They call it sod grass, or like turf grass.
Yep.
It's a combination of turf and it's a combination of grass. They've been growing it for 2 years, and at the same time, it's like, yeah, that's probably a cheaper way to, you know, you're able to maintain it a little bit easier. It doesn't deteriorate as quickly as actual grass does. But at the same time, like it is very clear that is not a playing surface that is conducive to it has no impact on the game. Like the field had an impact on the game, and it was a very negative impact.
Yep.
Turf has a negative impact. Players don't like it because of the ACLs, because it's tougher on the joints. And maybe it's the fact that the turf is too thin. It's not padded enough. I don't know specifically about the turf, but ultimately it just feels like grass is the best playing surface for players. They're able to wear, you know, thicker cleats, and it's dirt. It's not, yeah, I don't even know what's underneath side of this turf grass stuff. But you know, it's actual dirt. They're able to dig in it, and you don't see stuff like that slipping happens. The problem is it is a bitch to maintain. It is a lot of time, money, and effort, which, you know, these NFL teams do have, and the NFL does have. So it shouldn't be a problem in your biggest game, in your championship game. So I don't understand how it was that poorly done, but we'll have to see in the future what they choose to do regarding the field conditions, because you know the turf from last year in 2021, it was fine. Odell did tear his ACL in a non-contact injury, but you know guys were able to stay up on their feet and cut and do all those things without having to worry about falling.
And unfortunately, it affected the game. You know what I mean? Which is a sad thing.
Because the pass rush was literally
nothing.
Neither team was able to get to the quarterback. And it was the only way they were able to was with a free rusher. Like they had to scheme it up. They weren't able to get there with four. And that's where the Eagles had made their money this season, was being able to rush the passer with just four guys, right, and being able to keep seven in the back. The same way with running the football. Like this is a team that has made bread and butter was running the football, and they just couldn't do it. But the Chiefs could. So I don't know why they couldn't run the football, because let's be honest, the Chiefs defensive front isn't insane at stopping the run. Maybe it was just the fact that Nick Bolton had one of the best games of his career, and was all over the field, just filling holes, getting over blocks, making plays left and right. I mean, he was, I don't think Patrick Mahomes should have won the MVP. We talked about this. I don't think he was the most valuable player on the field. If you're going to ask me, it was between two guys. It was between Nick Bolton and it was between Jalen Hurts. And you know, the media always gives it to the winner. So, you know, maybe it should have been Nick Bolton.
Which is fine. I mean, there's some things there where it's like, you know, it's not really, it's you wanted to give it to, you know, the guy who propelled his team to victory.
Yeah.
But
because if you asked me who the MVP of the Super Bowl is, it was Jalen Hurts.
Right.
I mean, he scored four touchdowns. His offense couldn't
count for a ton of
his
yards.
Offense couldn't run the ball. And yet they still put up 35 points without any defensive scores, without getting any turnovers, without great special teams play. Like they scored straight up 35 points because of Jalen Hurts. And so I feel like that was a little bit of a, not really a slap in the face, but it was kind of insulting that he didn't win it. Meanwhile, Patrick Mahomes, who was 21-27, 182 yards and three touchdowns, gets it. Like we talked about this. Patrick Mahomes was fine. He was a game manager. He wasn't Patrick Mahomes, because I don't know if he could have been.
Yeah.
Although I will say the two
short fields,
the two runs he had were at least the first one was a little bit impressive. The second one, he just ran. Like, right. I mean, there wasn't anybody there. And so I don't.
Not make Getty miss.
Exactly. I don't want to. But like the first one, he was like moving a little bit, making guys. I was like, okay. Also, I don't know if you saw that. Saw that play on Twitter. The second one in the fourth quarter, Jordan Davis on that play gave, it was clear that Jordan Davis does not belong on a football field in the condition that he is in. A guy who everybody thought was going to be this insane player. I just don't know if it was the stamina thing. Like, he was running, and he was running slower than I think like a grandma. I mean, it was no effort. It was no agility, no speed for a guy who at the college level was like, oh my God, look at the plays that he's making.
Right. Yeah. And it, you know, runs a 4.7 40 or something.
Exactly.
Crazy like
and
that.
It was, I don't know if you've seen the clip, but you need to try and find it. And I'll try to find it and show it to you. But it was like, really? This is the guy you took 15th overall? But I do also want to say that Andy Reid called a fantastic game, or him and Eric Bieniemy in the second half called a fantastic game. We talked about the broken arrow. I think what was it, like week five, yep, of the season? Like some teams in the college world were running in it, and it was like, this play is insane. It was like, how do you stop it? And it just so happened that the Eagles run a defense that relies on communication and transferring, you know, pushing off receivers, and so they're worried about coming across and the little bit the arrow off of a jet sweep, so they want to carry over top, and the Chiefs see that like in week three or whatever, yep, and then they're like, okay, broken arrow, we're gonna pop back out, they're gonna have a miscommunication, and it's gonna be wide open. They did it twice and it scored both times, and there wasn't anybody within 10 yards.
Right.
And so just those little things, that's what I love about the game of football, is those little chess matches. It's the defense has rules that they follow. How are you gonna break them as an offense? Because I think it was Richard Sherman was talking about Seahawks cover three defense with Gus Bradley. And he was like, I think it was Kyle Shanahan. He was like, they literally made an offense that broke all of our rules. We covered it. We did exactly what we were supposed to within our defensive scheme, but they just ran a play that we could not account for. And so then it was like, back to the drawing board. Let's figure out more rules to then figure out how to stop this play. So it's that chess match is just really cool. But I thought it was a fantastic game. I really did.
Yep. That's the thing. That's what, you know, what's so interesting about that play specifically is it's virtually impossible to stop.
I mean, don't know how you stop it. Also,
running man-to-man defense in that situation, there's nothing you can do. I mean, they're just too good of athletes. And
I think what you have to do is you just have to play outside leverage on the motion, and then have another corner on the other side of the field that just takes it. Because like, if you don't play outside leverage, you are going to get beat on that play.
Right.
There's just no way.
It's just, they know what they're doing, but you don't know what but you can't predict what they're doing as a defender. It's just basic, you know, physics, I guess. When he's going one way and he knows he's going to cut back, it's tough for you to react. Yep. When you're going full speed,
exactly,
cover, you know, a jet sweep or whatever, exactly, it could be over there.
You almost have to like bracket it with the inside guy,
right,
because you still have the possibility of like a rub route inside too. And so you got to have that communication with the slot corner at that. It's like there's so many things that the offense can do off of that motion. It is very tough to stop, especially in the red zone when you only need a handful of yards. Another play that was nearly impossible to stop is the QB sneak when you have four guys pushing you from behind.
Yes.
There was some talk on Twitter. I saw the NFL possibly banning that, or at least the pushing part this offseason. Personally, I don't really see why you would ban it, because not a ton of teams use it. They're stupid.
True.
Meanwhile, the Eagles took full advantage of the rule and their powerful offensive line and were able to convert, I think, 37 first downs on 41 attempts this year is the number I saw.
Yeah.
Truly unbelievable numbers, but nobody ran it as much as the Eagles did. I don't know why. Like I always got so frustrated because the QB sneak, nose tackles say this, defensive tackles say this, it's the toughest play to stop when you only need 1 yard, and teams just won't run it. I don't get it. But I do think the pushing element makes it even tougher. So maybe they will get rid of it. I don't know. But like we talked about college, like they got rid of it for a decade and then brought it back.
Yep.
I don't know why.
Neither do I.
But they did. And so do you keep it? Do you not keep it? I don't know. I don't know. Are you good on the Super Bowl?
Yeah.
So we had some coaching hires, both of them coordinators of the Philadelphia Eagles, Shane Steichen. I think that's how you say it. I'm never going to be able to pronounce it right. And
Shane Steichen.
Steichen. Okay, we'll go with that. And what's Gannon's first name? Is it
Jonathan?
Jonathan. Yeah, it's Jonathan Gannon, the Eagles DC. So the OC Steichen and the DC Gannon. Gannon goes to Arizona. He's the new head coach of the Cardinals. And Steichen goes to the Indianapolis Colts, which means Jim Irsay did not hire Jeff Saturday, unfortunately. Thought that would have been really fun to follow for an entire season rather than just, you know, eight games or whatever it was. So those were the two big hires. I think everybody has their coach now.
Yep. Think so.
What are your thoughts? Because you're a Cardinals guy, because you're a Kyler guy, what are your thoughts about them hiring a defensive-oriented coach in Jonathan Gannon?
Well, first off, you know, I didn't think the Eagles' defense was fantastic all season. I think there were spots where they were really good, spots where they were really bad. But, you know, like Giants game, they were really good. You know, 49ers game, can't give a review on that.
Yeah.
But Chiefs game, awful. Mm-hmm. So just different areas where they were good and bad. But I think it's a solid hire. I think he knows how to run, you know, NFL team and can manage a culture. That aspect of Cliff Kingsbury never felt like it was truly there, mm-hmm. even when they were doing well. It was just chaos. So I do think he brings some order and some sanity there and doesn't really kind of rock the boat at all. But hiring a defensive guy, I think, has a really negative connotation in today's NFL because, you know, a lot of the head coaches that have had success have been all offensive guys, and that's yeah. fair and
well,
that's fine.
Right, but both the coaches in the Super Bowl were true. Offensive guys.
But, you know, you can have success with a defensive head coach, and I think with the Cardinals, when you have such a good quarterback like Kyler Murray, it's like, okay, well, we kind of have some of the offense down. Our problems mm-hmm. have been getting guys around him and then playing defense and actually being, you know, a solid defensive team. So I like it as long as you hire a really good offensive coach. I don't really mind the whole defensive coordinator thing becoming the head or defensive minded coach becoming a head coach, especially when you have a young quarterback. Yep. Everyone's like, oh, you need him to develop. Kyler's done the lion's share of his developing
yep.
already.
Yep.
He's what, I think year four going into? So
Is it really only four?
I think so. Because
it feels like he's been in the league a lot longer.
No, I don't think so. I think this is his fourth year. He was the year after Baker, and Baker.
No,
is,
then it's year because it's year five because Herbert, Burrow, and Tua are going into year okay. four.
Then, like I said, yeah, I mean, you know, really is pretty much done developing. I think that's the only reason why people would be like, oh, you need a head coach to develop your young quarterback. He's proven. He's developed, you know, as much as he's going to. I like the hire. And hopefully he locks up the Cardinals defense and they get a good offensive coordinator. That's really the bottom line. That's yep. what you have to do when you hire a defensive minded coach. So not too worried about it, but, you know, versus other hires, is it, you know, one of the worst ones? Sure. Honestly, I think you can make that argument because there have been a lot of good head coaches hired when you think about Sean Payton.
Yep.
And whatever you think about Shane Steichen
or Frank Reich.
I don't like that. I didn't really like that hire because I didn't think he was very good in Indianapolis. But, you know, I don't know. We'll see. I always like hiring coordinators over fired head coaches. But, you know, it's just me. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Because to me, the person you hire as your head coach is fully dependent on, you know, kind of where you are organizationally in a rebuild or in terms of competitiveness. Because when you have a young quarterback, like that's why I was so confused when the Bears hired Matt Eberflus last year. It was like you have a young quarterback that, and in year one, didn't really show any signs of being a capable NFL starting quarterback. Wouldn't you want him to be able to develop under an offensive guy? And they ended up hiring Luke Getsy, and we'll have to see what he's able to do. Given actual pieces to work with rather than some paper clips and toothpicks on his offensive on the offensive side of the ball. So I've always like, why don't, when you have a young quarterback or when you're planning on taking a young quarterback, why don't you hire an offensive guy? And then if it doesn't work out, but you know your quarterback is good, like the Cardinals, hire a defensive guy, because normally the reason why it isn't working out is because your defense sucks. Like, when you have a guy like Kyler, Why could it not be working out? Well, it's probably because your defense is a bottom 10 defense in the league. How do you fix that? You hire a guy that's pretty good defensively and coached a top five defense. That, you know, at its best was really, really good. Probably the first or second best defense in the NFL. But at its worst was like a mid-tier defense. Like they were a true roller coaster team on the defensive side of the ball. Speaking, going back to the offensive side, I feel like this hire for the Colts and Shane Steichen basically tells us that they're taking a quarterback in the first round, whether it's at four or whether they trade up to one. Because why else would you hire an offensive guy again
if he has absolutely nothing to cook with?
Exactly. So now it just becomes about which quarterback they go with. And there's a myriad of different options for them. Will they trade up? Will they stay at four? There's four, in my opinion, there's four first-round quarterbacks. And I guess a little bit of a sneak peek teaser. We're going to have our quarterback rankings. I think we're going to do top six, maybe top seven. We'll figure that out. I think it's going to be six, though. We're going to do our top six quarterbacks in this class as of right now, pre-combine, stuff like that. So still a lot to come out. We're going to give comps with them as well. So you kind of get a feel for what the player is. But that's a little teaser. It's coming in probably in a couple days. I don't know if I'm going to do it Saturday, put it out Saturday, or put it out on Monday. We'll still see about that one. But I think that this is basically a foregone conclusion now that the Colts take quarterback in the first round. Honestly, if I'm them, I stay at four.
Yep.
I think that you can get your guy at four. It might not be Bryce Young, but you can still get a guy at four and not have to, you know, give other picks up to go.
I would stay at four given what I think the price will be to go up to one from what I've seen, because I would not, like, I like Bryce Young a lot, and we'll get into this later on, but it's not worth the three first round picks that you're giving up
and to move maybe up three spots.
Right. Like, it's just not. And obviously 4-1 is a huge difference, but at the end of the day, there isn't a huge difference between, you know, Bryce Young and CJ Stroud or Bryce Young and whoever you might else like. So it'll be interesting to see what they do. But like you said, I think you can get a really good quarterback at four, and I think that's what I would do.
Losing that Texans game was huge for them. Right. It really was, because I think the difference was them picking five and picking four maybe, or six and four. I'm not exactly sure, but it also made the Texans pick two. And so maybe the Texans are the ones, because you put up some smoke screens. Oh, we're going to trade up to one. Texans are like, oh, we got to get our guy. Let's trade up the one spot, give up a little too much to do so. And, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens over the next couple of months, just in those top four picks, because the Cardinals are going to stay pat. They're going to get one of the top two defensive guys in the class. And I really don't think they're going to be mad with either one they get there.
Yep.
They're, for any team, they're probably in the best spot, just because I think it's more than likely they get either Jalen Carter or Will Anderson. There is a very, very awful possibility that the Bears go Jalen Carter, Will Anderson, and then so do the Texans.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if you're the Cardinals, it's tough to trade back, because everybody's like, oh, all the quarterbacks are still on the board. And, you know, the next best defensive player is Tyree Wilson. And that's a huge fall off. I don't know if I would take Tyree Wilson at three. I mean, when you talk about being in the top three picks, it's like you want a blue chip prospect.
Right.
There's only, you know, a handful of them in this class. And then when you look at positional value, it's like, do you really want to do it? And so I'm very intrigued to see what happens there. But I do think that more likely than not, we see somebody trade up, whether it is the Panthers or the Colts or even the Raiders trade up. But I thought that those were two interesting hires, especially because I thought Lou Anarumo, the Bengals DC, would have been a better hire for the Cardinals than Gannon, just based off of, you know, what kind of division the Cardinals play in, where there is a bunch of, it's not just great quarterbacks, but it's great offenses. And you've seen what the Bengals defense has been able to do against the Chiefs and the Bills and you know, even the Ravens to an extent. And so they only get beat by guys like Baker Mayfield.
Right.
And
true.
And they're, I guess Baker's technically is in that division. Maybe that's why they didn't hire him. Yeah. But, you know, it felt to me like the wrong hire. It is what it is. As for the Colts, Steichen, he started calling plays in like week five, and he did a fantastic job. So I'm not really too worried about that. I do think it's odd that Eric Bieniemy again, doesn't get, I mean, he wasn't even interviewed for four of the five jobs.
Yeah.
To me, and I want to get your thoughts on this too, just because this is a hot topic discussion as well. It feels like there's a deal in place that when Andy Reid retires, it's Eric Bieniemy's job. Like, that's what it feels like to me, because it is weird that he hasn't been, you know, he wasn't interviewed more in this cycle, or he hasn't even been offered a job yet. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I would be a bit surprised if Andy Reid retired anytime soon.
He talked about the possibility of it in an interview before the Super Bowl. He said, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, I think he is 70.
He's 64.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He looks like he's 70.
Yeah, he does. I think that...
then maybe not.
I it is interesting because it does seem like Bieniemy is, like, he's open to taking interviews. You know what I mean? It's not like he's like, oh, well, sure, maybe I'll interview, but I really don't really want it. I think there is, you know, in, especially in league circles, like, there is probably a bit of an understanding that, hey, this guy's really... Like, you know, you take the Eagles OC, for example, and it's like he's calling plays, he's really involved with the offense, he's a large portion of for their success that we're not in on. You know what I mean? The audience, us, you know, NFL fans, people on Twitter, I don't think we really understand or have the intel that the guys on the inside do, like, you know, whether it be the Cardinals GM or the Colts GM or whoever, that, okay, this guy... You know, was the Eagles OC, and he means so much to that offense, and was a real reason for their success.
It was really weird because Sirianni started the season calling plays. He called plays for them last year and was like, yeah, no, this isn't going to work, and then handed it over, and then all of a sudden, like, there wasn't a drop-off, or they were, you know, even a tad bit better at points. So Gardner Minshew put up, you know, 34 points.
Right. And with Eric Bieniemy, I'm guessing the thought process is for... You know, league circles and GMs, is it him or is it Andy Reid? And, you know, I don't know. I think maybe there is a portion of, you know, how much, you know, him and Mahomes had beef, and that was documented, and some of the players on that team don't love Bieniemy. Is he, you know, the right guy to handle our team? But again, if it's me, from what I know, I would hire him. You know what I mean? I've said this for the past 3 or 4 years. So
I wanted him when the Lions job was open. I was like either him or Saleh. I didn't even think about Dan Campbell.
Right. So again, I think there is like almost a naivety to, you know, how everybody else looks at head coaching hires, and we think, oh, that guy's a bust and that guy should be hired. And maybe we just don't know. Exactly. I don't know. That's what I'm guessing. But from what I know, yes, I think he should be hired, and I'm surprised he hasn't been.
Well, there's also the facet of the Washington Commanders likely getting sold here in the upcoming weeks. And finally, Dan Snyder should have been gone a while ago. Talk about a scumbag. But now that he's out, I know Bezos has put in an offer. There's another group. I can't remember who was the major backer of it, but there's another group, and I think they're the front runners right now. The same people that own the Sixers, I think, is what I saw. Mm. So they're the front runners right now, and there's talk that if they do successfully buy the team, that Ron Rivera and his entire staff is out. And so I have seen that Eric Bieniemy is in the eyes of those people as a potential OC, not head coach. But that also begs the question, then who would be the head coach there? Yeah. So I think that's another interesting search to watch, just because of how late we are in the process too. I mean, it's February, you know, 17th when you're listening to this, and the draft is at the end of April. We got the combine coming in, I think, like 3 weeks. So you need to have this fleshed out, and if you don't, then you're behind the eight ball. And I guess the good thing is that, or if you want a guy, he should be on a staff already, because they're going to be doing scouting already, and they'll get that inside information. But like a guy like Jim Caldwell, who just got hired by the Panthers, I think he's like the
senior assistant.
Exactly. Yeah. But like he hasn't been in football in a little bit, and I don't know how much he's been watching like college kids tape, but it's like if you get a guy like that, how quickly is going to be able to hit the ground running or whatnot. So I do think that getting a guy like Bieniemy, who's done it a bunch of years, has already looked at this class, just to be your head coach. Like I don't even think he just needs to come on as the OC. I think being the head coach is probably, I don't know, because other than him, I don't know who would be. I know Aaron Glenn might be a name. He was just when Gannon was hired in Arizona, I think that was his final spot that a team was interested in him. So, or maybe it was the Colts. I don't remember. But there's a couple other coordinators around the league, like Anarumo, possibly. But I don't know. I'm interested to see what happens with that one though, because it's been such a weird head coaching cycle.
Yeah, I think just touching back on Arizona, it's interesting because of the defensive guys. It's like, how do you compare, you know, talent with how they did?
Exactly.
And I think that was interesting with Philadelphia, because as talented as they are going into the season, I predicted them to be an average defense, but one of the best offenses in the NFL.
That's kind
of
how I had them
and
too.
And, you know, personally, you look at Hassan Reddick's career going back before
his stint. The Cardinals used him completely wrong. Right.
But going back to his stint in Arizona, he wasn't a good player. And, you know, some of their defensive players, C.J. Gardner-Johnson, mm-hmm. even, you know, on the Saints, he was not a very good, not a great corner with New Orleans, and has blossomed into a very good
player. James Bradbury was good, but, like, I mean, he was a potential like fringe top 10 corner for a lot of this season. So
yeah, he was a little bit too honest for my liking, but so many of their guys just seemed like, you know, average players and really blossomed into really good players. And with the Bengals, I think it's something similar. So it's tough to compare defensive, you know, production, but
The funny thing, quick story before we end this, but the funny thing about the Hassan Reddick thing is I really loved him coming out of Temple. Like, he was one of my favorite players in the class. And then I didn't really understand this, because this was, I mean, he's what, year five now? Year six, maybe? So this was like before I really like understood what the draft like was in depth, and really like started to watch players play. And so I was like, oh, dang it. I was wrong about him. He sucks. And then this year it's like, oh, Hassan Reddick's going to the Eagles. And it's like, yeah, the Cardinals were using him as an off-ball linebacker. Mm-hmm. I was like, wait, what? I was like, you're talking to me, a guy who came in as an edge rusher was your essentially like will linebacker. I was like, wait, what are we doing? And then he's a dog in Philadelphia, and I feel a little bit better about it. But, that was one of those where I was like, because I didn't understand. I didn't understand the whole fit thing. It was just like, oh, this player is good or this player is not good. It's right. Like, he goes to the Cardinals and he's terrible. It's like, well, he wasn't playing the position that was meant for him. It'd be like Micah playing off-ball linebacker. It's like, we saw it. He can do it fine. But Michael Parsons is an elite edge rusher.
I think with Reddick and with Parsons, the idea is these guys are so fast and athletic. Let's just put them as a linebacker and have them guard these, you know, shifty running backs or tight ends or whomever. But in reality, it's like you can use that athleticism along the D line, and they can absolutely wreak havoc like Hassan Reddick did in the playoffs and in the regular season.
I saw somebody on Twitter say, and this is an interesting take, a guy like Nick Bolton, who wasn't the most athletic player that you can get in the second or third round, is almost better than taking a freaky athletic linebacker that was just able to rely on athleticism in college and high school to get all of their production. Meanwhile, a guy like Nick Bolton, who I think his 40 was like a 4.7, like he's not fast, but his technique was really good, and it that translate, especially in a position like linebacker where it's tough to translate, like having the technique down and being able to, you know, just know where you're supposed to be at all times is more important than a guy like Devin Lloyd, who was just a freak athlete, but you know, he gets in the NFL field, and then all of a sudden this year he's benched for, what was it, Chad Muma, who wasn't the most athletic guy out of Wyoming. He just kind of did his job. And so, I don't know, that was an interesting take. But
it's kind of like NBA guys almost. It's like sometimes, you know, you'd rather have a Duncan Robinson or whoever who can just absolutely knock down shots because they've always had to rely on, like Jason Preston, for example.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
He always had to rely on, you know, great passing and making incredibly, not even athletic plays, but just incredible plays and, you know, duck down in between.
Yep.
Just do things that a smaller guard would have to do. And then he blossoms up to a 6'4 or 6'5, you know, point guard. And it's all of a sudden all of those smaller, or he still plays like a small guard, even though he's 6'4", and it's just makes for a really fun to watch player.
Yeah. You good?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you guys so much for watching. Hope you enjoyed. Catch you on the flip. See ya.